Okay, we're going to get started. Of course, we always talk about what's happening in Washington and what's happening with some of our grantees. And this is the 243rd call we've had. We're going to be talking to Oregon tradeswomen and all women's environmental and building trades organization. That's this week. Our next PLC will be December 2nd. And then we've got one more in this cohort, December 2nd, and then we have one on this 14th. And then we're going to take a break, and that'll complete the 10. We do cycles of 10. And so then we'll take a holiday break, and then we'll start up again in January. And, of course, that cycle, we should start thinking about the new grantees and what's happening in EPA and what that schedule is going to look like. Just for background, they're evaluating ranking criteria right now. We call this the long wait. It takes a while. They're checking everything out. They're looking at a short list that they'll pass on to the administrator, and then they'll come out with an announcement of those that are recommended for funding. And then, of course, after that, they take that group and they work over their work plans, and then they finalize it. So generally, the schedule, we don't know the schedule exactly, but from past cycles, probably we might get lucky and get January, February for these announcements. The announcements come out, and then, of course, then there's a process of getting your work plan together and finalizing things, so that might be March or April. And we'll be talking about some of the things that HMTRI will be doing in the springtime. And then probably you'll be getting your program together and maybe start organizing your first cohort, maybe in the summer or in the fall. And for those of you who are not grantees yet or have not submitted a proposal, there'll be, in all likelihood, a new RFP coming out. We call them RFAs, Requests for Application. That'll probably be, if they true to form, that might be coming out in the summer. If they follow the path, it might be, the proposals might be due in August or so, and then they'll go through the same type of, those will be FY, the federal fiscal year 22, and those will all be, you know, again, three-year grants, $200,000 each, unless something wonderful happens, it might change. But we're anticipating that type of schedule. And those of you who submitted, I think this is going to be a great grant year for them, because there is usually a stipulation that if you applied last year, you couldn't apply again. So we had some really good grantees that, beyond my rationale why they weren't selected in the last round, and they really should be in there. So I'm looking really positive to bring back some really good grantees and then some new ones. So we're looking forward to that. As far as the program goes, I think everything is really positive right now, looking positive. So we're going to move forward on that assumption. So we always talk about news from Washington. And also, if you're not getting notes, we send out notes on Friday. And we also have a website. So for those of you who are brand new, I'm going to turn this over to Heather to talk about news from Washington and news from HMTRI. So Heather, do you want to go forward?
Yeah, absolutely. So news from Washington, you know, it's like Mike mentioned, this is kind of a bit of a quiet time. It's that long wait. So really no new news from HQ right now. I reached out to them and they kind of just sat back and said, you know, nothing new right now. But one thing that we are reminding folks, and something that we do try to remind folks every time, is just to keep in your calendar that Brownfields 2021, this is the National Brownfields Conference, is slated for September 27th through the 30th, 2021 in Oklahoma City, Oklahoma. So go ahead and you can kind of pencil that in on your calendar. If you want to learn more information about it, you can go to brownfields2021.org. Again, that's brownfields2021.org. HMTRI is tentatively right now planning on having an affiliate event maybe the day before, something special for the EWGDAT folks to get together and discuss everything that's environmental workforce development and job training related that's kind of associated with the National Brownfields Conference right around there. So we're looking at that. But because that is slated for September, we are looking at having our annual all-grantee meeting virtual again this year, but we're looking at doing it in early spring, late spring, so something maybe in the April or May timeframe. We've got a couple of dates that we have sent out to the EPA folk to get their feedback on, and so we'll send out a couple of dates to the listserv for your guys' feedback as soon as we kind of hear back from EPA on what they think for a couple of date options. So we're trying to kind of get a couple of things in the work, and we're already looking at next year and what are the potential for that fantastic annual all-grantee meeting. That's the time where we get folks together and really do a deep dive into environmental workforce development and job training topics. But we are looking at holding that again virtually for next year, simply because if we hold an affiliate event that's associated with the National Brownfields Conference in September, we just didn't want to do them so back-to-back to kind of constrain everybody in terms of travel and where that's at. So keep that in mind as we're kind of planning ahead and looking ahead. As Mike mentioned, he sends out absolutely fantastic notes on Friday. I encourage everybody to check your inboxes for those. I will tell you he goes above and beyond the scope of what's discussed during these meetings. They go far more in-depth and have lots of really, really good information on them. If you don't receive them, send me an email and we'll get you put on those listserv. That's a special listserv just for the PLC folks. You can send me an email at hkballou@eicc.edu. Again, that's hkballou@eicc.edu. And we can get you put on the PLC listserv, and that's where you get notes on Friday as well as some extra reminders for the PLC calls that occur. You can also send me an email if you don't get any listserv posts from me. That's the second listserv that we keep. It's a little bit of a bigger one that you would kind of send some more broad information to as well. All right, Mike, I'm going to turn it back over to you. I think those are my kind of couple key points to talk about.
That's great. And if you read the notes, we include them in the emails so that they might be easier to read. And if there's something that you want to add or subtract to those notes, just respond to the PLC notes. It'll be msenyu@gmail.com. If you read them and say, well, I don't agree with you, or something different, or something to add, or if you'd like to talk about your program, we're always looking for things that people are doing. What the grantees are doing, you could just respond to those notes. Just hit reply and put in any ideas or suggestions you might have, and we'd be happy to work with you on that. So today we're going to talk about, as I said before the call started, we're looking at diverse workforces, and of course, now more than ever, we've got 50% representation of women, and it's a new day in terms of needing people with skills. It's a good time to recognize the skills that women have, and particularly in the environmental fields and the construction trades. And just about every grantee has some women in their program. Some have more than others. Cypress Mandela has had classes as many as 50% women. No other program has had been 100% women as Oregon tradeswomen. And I think we could learn something from them. They've done an incredible job. They started with the Environmental Workforce and Development Job Training Program in 2004, and they've competed successfully for 6 grants since then. So they've got deep experience in working with women successfully in the environmental trades, very similar to Cypress Mandela, that trades gives everyone a background in tools and construction and then takes the cream of the crop and gives them additional environmental training that gives them a head up in the job market, that they've done a tremendous job. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Kelly, the executive director. Kelly, is your name pronounced Kupchak?
It is. So thank you so much. Right. Yeah, okay. You have it right. Thanks, Michael, because most people, when they see it in writing, think it's cupcake. So I appreciate that. And thank you so much for the nice introduction. It's a pleasure to be here with folks today. And we have been really honored to be a grantee since 2004. And we actually took a year off. We did not apply for this cycle because we wanted to spend some time with our industry partners kind of reorganizing the way that we do our training, and I'll talk a little bit about that, but I'm hoping that our training manager can begin to participate in January and both learn from new grantees and also share some deep experience that we've gathered over the years through our program. But as Michael said, Oregon Tradeswoman has served 100% women or folks that identify as women or non-binary or gender non-conforming, and we are headquartered in Portland, Oregon, and we embed our environmental worker training program as part of our eight-week apprenticeship readiness program. So the folks that participate, we only serve adults, so you have to be 18 or over, and identify as women because women remain largely underrepresented in environmental careers and in the skilled trades. Not in terms of more professional careers in the environmental sector. In fact, more women comprise environmental engineers than men. But when we're talking about folks on the ground who are working through a skilled trades position or working in a position that does not require a degree, there are very few women. Nationally, there's about 3% of women in the workforce, and in Oregon, we have closer to 9, which even though that's more than double the national average, we still think that's not enough because these are incredible careers, as everybody on the call knows. And so we're just going to share a little bit today about why we focus on women and how we recruit for our class. So we've been around for 31 years now. We started out in 1989. And the reason that we focus our outreach and recruitment and career education efforts on women is because, as we just said, and Michael noted at the beginning of this call today, that while women make up half of our nation's workforce, so few of us are represented in these high-wage, high-skilled jobs in environmental sectors and skilled trades. So we think that's an incredibly productive pathway to prosperity, and a significant number of the women that we serve are women who are low income. In fact, last year, 73% of the women we served were receiving SNAP or TANF or other forms of government benefits, and were very much underemployed and unemployed. And our starting wage after placement is $20.31. So that's significantly higher than the minimum wage in Oregon, as well as Southwest Washington, where we serve folks. And so we're really proud of that because we have a very high placement rate, 87%, and we have a very strong retention rate. After 12 months, we're still seeing 93% of folks being retained in their career pathway. So where do we find women? We find women in all the places that you can imagine. Child care centers, schools, grocery stores, athletic clubs, recreation centers, laundromats, places where women are just doing regular things, right? So sometimes we laugh when we're doing presentations like this to employers because it seems like they think there's a big mystery to where to find women. And we're like, they're everywhere. But it's really about presenting your program and the opportunities for pathways in environmental jobs in a way that women can resonate with. So oftentimes, we will see marketing materials, as an example, that only have pictures of white men. And no offense to those folks. But we make sure that all of our marketing materials, our brochures, our social media posts, anything that we're doing has images of women working in these careers. And if it's okay, Michael, I have a PowerPoint I can send if you wouldn't mind sharing it with folks. And it has a link to our tradeswomen image library, and folks are free to use any images. And they're all real trades workers. I'm working in a variety of careers, solar, environmental remediation, and other skilled trades jobs. If folks would like to use any of those images for their own marketing materials, they're free to do so. So we really focus a lot on how we present those materials and how we talk about career education and career pathways in the environmental sector. And a lot of times we see that largely folks don't actually know what those jobs are. Like they'll hear about an environmental engineer, but they don't really know what are the trades jobs associated. So we, before COVID, we did a lot of panels with women speaking to high school students, middle school students, as well as job seekers in our local unemployment offices. And we've shifted, because of COVID, to doing all of those things virtually. And we've seen an uptick in folks participating and asking for help in navigating how to get into these skilled careers. So we have the motto, if you can't see it, you can't be it, which is why we started both a video library that has videos of different trades and occupations. We have solar installers, environmental remediation workers, and other careers that folks can use those videos as career education, and also, as I mentioned earlier, our tradeswomen library. And we have seen that those things can really help when you're talking to women about looking at these opportunities to come into the program. We also encourage programs to consider, if you don't have staff that are women, to at least invite women from the industry to come in and speak to your class about their exciting and dynamic careers. Not only does it help the folks who are in your class or who you're potentially recruiting get excited about those opportunities, it's also a leadership development opportunity for those women who you've invited to speak on behalf of your program. And we've seen studies that demonstrate when women are actively involved with mentoring and supporting other women in our industry, it increases their retention as well as the women that they're working with. So last year we developed a trades ambassador program to help specifically with women and also people of color. Folks might be aware that Black, Indigenous, and other people of color are also underrepresented in these careers. And so we worked hard to recruit folks to be in that capacity to basically be a champion for our program. And in our program, our training staff at this moment are all women who come from the trade. So they definitely get to see the people in our program see themselves in our staff. And that has been helpful for a number of women. But we do work very closely, too, with our employer and registered apprenticeship program partners. And they rotate in their staff as part of our hands-on portion. And certainly not all of their staff are women, but it's definitely helpful for our participants to see women in those careers being successful. As part of our own program, as I mentioned, the 8-week apprenticeship readiness is 192 hours, and it's a mix of classroom, lab, and hands-on. This year, we shifted all of our classrooms to virtual, and we had to shift our hands-on training in person to a COVID-safe practice, so a good decrease on the number of folks we were able to serve in a given cohort due to COVID restrictions and safety protocols. But we anticipate, keeping those in place until the pandemic has subsided. In a typical year, we serve about 120 women. And this year, we have served about half of that because it took us a minute to reconfigure with the transition into a virtual learning environment. But we were still able to work really closely with our apprenticeship and employer partners, and we did a virtual employer meet and greet that was actually really successful. So we were very excited about that. We work closely with employers. One of our largest employers for environmental careers in our region is our local metropolitan government, which manages a number of, it manages a recycling, a paint program, a lead abatement program, weatherization program, and we also work with our solar association. So we have a great opportunity for folks coming through our program to go directly to work or registered apprenticeship for folks who are interested, particularly with a large number of women that go into our labor apprenticeship and training through the union, and they are doing environmental remediation work. So folks come through our program, have a certificate of completion that's recognized by our State Bureau of Labor and Industries Apprenticeship and Training Division, as well as the House Offer 40-hour certification, First Aid, PCR. They also can get forklifts, lab renovations, and asbestos awareness remediation. So they come out in a very short time through our program being ready to go to work and earn good wages in jobs that have a career pathway and include benefits. And our program is at no cost to any of the adult job seekers we serve. About 53% of the women we serve are women of color, and 40% are single moms. And we have a significant number also, about 15% coming from the reentry community. So coming from the So I know, Michael, you asked me too to talk a little bit about challenges that women might face, and there's probably no surprises there. Folks on the call, I'm sure, are aware that because women are still so underrepresented in these fields, they often can face on the job site harassment or discrimination or isolation, which can be challenging to deal with. And oftentimes we know that women are, you know, trying to juggle demands and competing family responsibilities. And so we have social workers on our staff that work with women coming to our program to help them identify any potential barriers to success in their career pathway. And we work also on the other side of our team. We have folks that do technical assistance for our industry partners about making their job sites and their companies and their apprenticeship programs more welcoming to women, because we certainly see there's a lot of assets that women bring to the job and bring to the industry. And so we really don't want to prepare women to go into good careers just to be pushed out because of a bad environment. So we do the advocacy piece as part and parcel of how we approach gender equity. So I don't, if folks have questions, I'm happy to take any of those. And thanks again for the opportunity to share our program.
You know, Oregon Tradeswoman has an incredible website, and I would encourage everyone to go on their website, but then go on to their Facebook page, because this is what a Facebook page should look like. The impression I get as I go through their materials is this is a very social organization. They rely heavily on mentoring. Tuesday nights, last Tuesday night of every a month, they have a social hour, and I guess they're going virtual. Is that right, Kelly? Are you going?
Yeah, we're virtual this whole year, and it's been really great because we were, if I could just share this, Michael, we were really nervous about the doing this work virtually because so much of the success of the women in our program is like through that bonding, and I'm sure that other grantees see that too in the program. There's like a natural bonding, like folks that come through the cohort together, and they take that out into the job site when they graduate. You know, see women on the job saying, "Oh, you went to Oregon Trace Women," and they're wearing our shirts and things like that. But you know, we were worried how that was going to happen with COVID. But to be honest with you, we've seen the same level of bonding and folks showing up on our virtual social hours, and anybody's welcome to come to them. And sometimes we have topics that are pertinent specifically to women in the trades, and other times continuing education. And then some of the social hours are just like getting together, and the folks on the call share their own resources with one another. So it's a really great opportunity to build community and support.
You know, you go to their Facebook page and read some of the articles, and the students use the website. It's just not a for-show Facebook page. We have a Facebook page. There was one. It was a little 3-minute video. A woman said there were some ugly things that happened at work today, and I want to tell you about it. And, I mean, things like that. And I just felt that there was a community of people, whether they were women or men or mixed, but that it wouldn't matter. But it has to ask the grantees the questions, you know, are we really all inclusive? Are we coming to class, doing our class, and everyone going home? Or do we have a program that, you know, you're part of this, and you're going to be a part of it for a while. They have that attitude, we're going to track you for 2 years. If you need help, come back, you know. Or they won't. I get the feeling there's a lot of people that go to that Facebook page or those happy hours virtual that have graduated and may have opportunities that people could take advantage of. And you don't see that in a lot of programs.
Yeah, thank you for pointing that out and sharing that, Michael. I appreciate it. One thing I forgot to mention, too, is we do have an annual Tradeswomen Leadership Institute, and it is, we just started, we'll be doing that virtually this year, but in years past, it's been in person, and it's a really great opportunity for women in environmental and trade careers to come together and learn about topics. All of the topics are presented by tradeswomen for tradeswomen. So it's a really incredible event. We had 130 women last year. So if anyone's interested in starting something like that, please feel free to reach out to us. We're happy to share any of our resources and the model if that's something folks are interested in.
Well, the other interesting thing is your students wear uniforms, but these are the trades. They're used to wearing trades uniforms, so they get comfortable. So that they go to an interview or they go out to the job, they're not going to stick out like other people might. They're going to feel comfortable with the tools, and they're going to feel comfortable with their uniforms, whatever their construction materials are. I think that's a great approach. It actually goes a step further than many grantees will have. Well, we're going to have business hours, whether it's, you know, if it's construction-oriented, and many environmental jobs are construction-oriented. We're going to go from 7 to 4 or 8 to 5, and we're going to get people to use job ready, get on the job. They're going a step further. They're going to wear the uniforms. They're going to be able to pick up a tool and be comfortable with it. What's interesting about this program, and the same with arts program, they do construction first. They're running their construction program, but then they take the cream of the crop, and those who want to move on then go into the environmental program. And those people really have a step up, because they can not only have the apprenticeships and the certs associated with the construction trades, general construction or whatever, OSHA 10, but then they'll have the, whether it's a HAZWOPR, the RRMP, the asbestos, so they'll be able to go on jobs that the other graduates wouldn't be able to go on, because they've got this extra, what would you say, a 3 or 4 weeks program after your construction trades? Is that how you would work that, Kelly?
I'm sorry, could you repeat that, Michael? I just had my phone.
Oh, that's fine. You do your, you give everyone a basic construction background so they're comfortable with the tools, they're comfortable where. And then, as part of your recruitment, as I understand it, you kind of take those who are motivated and want to get the extra environmental, environmental workforce development, then you put them in almost like an advanced program, which gets them additional
credentials. It's a three-week boot camp. So anybody who comes through, and we actually tried it. We sort of did a test pilot last year with a cohort where we just said, oh, anybody who's interested can apply and come into our environmental worker boot camp. And the way that we've historically done it and gone back to doing it is that we require that you go through our trades and apprenticeship readiness full 192-hour program first. Because what we've seen is those folks are much more prepared for success. And if they just come straight into a three-week boot camp, they really don't have the foundational background and training and understanding of the industry to be successful. So that's part of what led us to deciding to not apply this year and take some time to work more deeply with our partners so that we can go back to doing it the way we've done, which is folks come first through the apprenticeship readiness and then the three-week intensive environmental, but then offering some additional, like, basic, more in-depth career education and awareness so folks can think about, hey, I didn't know what solar installers did before. Hey, I didn't know what, you know, an insulator did before, things like that. But we really, what we've learned over the years is that foundational piece is really critical for folks to be successful, especially for women. So did that answer
your question? It's an interesting model. We've got many grantees who you apply for the Environmental Workforce Development Job Training Program. You go through that program, could be 8 weeks, could be much longer or a little shorter, and then you graduate. And then we've got models similar to yours and our Eric Shanks, Cypress Mandela, some others that say, okay, we're going to give you a pre-program, and many front-load that with other things, not necessarily construction trades. They might do their life skills up front, and they do the non-EPA supported things up front. Of course, you have to support that with other money, but you might have construction trades or whatever, and then you take the most motivated, the most deserving, and it's part of almost like your screening process. And you use the tryouts type process too, don't you? Where you're selecting your students.
Yeah.
So your graduates have.
We do, and I think the other piece I appreciate you bringing up is the piece around non-EPA funds. We're very lucky in that we're able to leverage other funding sources to have a very robust, you know, general construction readiness program, and we embed throughout the program the soft skills pieces. So the resume writing, interviewing, math for the industry, all of those things, physical fitness, right? Because environmental jobs, you have to be really physically fit for those. So we embed all of that into the readiness portion, the eight-week program. And we've seen that going through that first and folks who are really motivated who then go into the environmental worker boot camp are far more successful than if they don't. And so that one sort of pilot that we did, it really told us, hey, you're doing this the right way. And it's, you know, I think the challenging piece is for adult job seekers because at this point we don't have stipends, but we are offering an evening and weekend class. So folks who, you know, need to have an income, it's not a program that's 6 months long, right? It's 8 weeks. So it still is a significant portion of someone's time commitment. Then in 8 weeks, they're ready for a brand new career that is going to have family living wages. So we are committed to always trying to improve that. So someday, when someone gives us a big bag of $1 million, we'll be able to provide stipends for job seekers, but right now that's not something our program offers, and that's a challenge for some folks.
And that's the challenge with the environmental program. It's they're running on fumes. And, of course, all of the things, whether it's pre-training or non-EPA training, you've got to have some really strong partners. So when we're working with women in our participant list, we have to be mindful, not that we're going to discriminate someone with their gender, but we're trying to establish a gender-neutral program. We have to carry that from the awareness to the recruitment to the retention, all the way through to placement and tracking. But we have to do it in a way that is gender neutral, which means we all have to ask ourselves, if we've got women in our program, do we have some women instructors? Which may be a reason, as you're recruiting your instructors, do you have women that can relate to our people? Do you have on your Facebook page or on your website, do you have graduation classes of women with women in there? Are people wearing gender-neutral clothes in your program? You know, are you now this program? You have strength training as part of yours, but you know, people like Cypress Mandela, they have strength training. They do exercises every morning. So you have to ask the question: are you doing that? Are you including it in your as part of your recruitment? The idea of you have to have some 280-pound male in there. We have a lot of programs with other ethnicities, and these people in those groups may or may not have the physical ability that women have, and women may be better suited to certain jobs, whether it's temperature or whatever it is.
They sure are, especially when you think about confined spaces. All the, you know, little tiny women from our program can get into places that some of the folks that you're describing can't. So there's a lot of assets that folks bring. And that's one thing we talk about in our program too, Michael, is it doesn't matter about your gender or your size. Trades workers, environmental workers come in all different shapes and sizes and colors. And it's really about your skills, your knowledge, your abilities, and really most importantly, your attitude. So if you're willing to learn, you want to work hard, and you want a career, that's what's going to get you farther to success than anything else, right?
I think that's true. Does anyone have questions of Kelly? And Kelly, you send me that PowerPoint, and I'll put it in with the notes. And I assume that if anyone has any questions, I'll have your email in there that they could talk to you about, whether it's instructors or training or recruitment.
That's absolutely. Okay. I'll make sure that my contact information and our training director's contact information are in there. Thanks, Michael, for the opportunity.
Mm-hmm. Any questions of Kelly? Okay. Well, I think it's important that we try to develop these gender-neutral programs and make sure that someone doesn't feel they're an oddball. I went through an engineering program and it was terrible at Purdue. I mean, these were all male engineers, and the poor women that had to go through that program were basically discriminated against, I would have to say. And that should not be the case. And certainly this heavy emphasis on social events and gender neutrality throughout the program, I think, can make a program so much better than it might otherwise be. So, any other questions that anyone might have? Okay. Well, Will, with that, we're going to wind up today, and we'll talk to you all on December 2nd. Same time, same place, same call-in number. And you all have a great afternoon. Okay?
Thank you. Happy Thanksgiving.
Thank you. Thank you all.
Thank you.
Good job,
Thank
Mike.
You.
Thank you.